Let me introduce you to my next guest on episode 3. So I did an interview with Lawrence, and Lawrence is my uncle. And I do have to put that out there because anyone that's growing up in the same similar upbringing to me, respect for your elders, it's very hard to call your uncle or auntie by the first name. So I do call him uncle because I just can't help it, and I absolutely love Uncle Lawrence. And I invited him onto my show and get an older voice, the generation above me, onto the show. He, as always, had some really pearly words of wisdom, and I do at some point talk about some advice that he once gave me, which I'll never forget. My Uncle Lawrence also has served, as you'll know, as we listen to go into the interview, as a firefighter in the West Midlands Fire Service for over 25 years. As the course of our interview go on, we do talk about subjects that may be triggering for some listeners. And so I want to let you know this is going to be a two-parter, and the subjects will really come up in the second part of the interview. We do talk about a description of traumatic events and accidents, and also suicide. If either of those subjects is a trigger for you, then please, I will say, do not listen to this interview. They are serious subjects, and I will say to anyone listening that if you feel triggered or suicidal in any way, and especially with the harshness realities of this pandemic, or even coming out of this pandemic, may also be a trigger for anyone out there, my listeners, or someone that you know. There are advice helplines out there to help you. There are people that will listen. And most importantly to my listeners, I would always say, check in with each other. Check in with that friend, especially the quiet ones, and the men. Because we do touch on the subject of male suicide, and there are men that, you know, older than us in the older generation that are struggling, that feel like there's no way out and nowhere to talk, no one to talk to. So check in on them. Check in on your elders. Check in on your elder male. Check in on your friends. And we'll get through and out of this together. So without further ado, here is my interview with Lawrence. I asked him my 3, maybe actually more 4 favourite questions. And here is how he got on. Enjoy. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about Uncle Lawrence. And you know, he was born and raised in West Bromwich in the early 1960s. And I think there's a few famous exports from the Black Country from around that time. If you know, you know. But I'm thinking of a comedian called Lainey Henry at the same time. And what can I say? So my Uncle Lawrence started off as a young lad growing up, had a fascination with motor cars. And motorsports. And one thing I didn't realise as well was Uncle Lawrence was a keen footballer. And you said you was playing for 2 different teams. How old was you at age 14?
Yeah, up to about the age of 14. I played for a couple of football teams. I played for the church football team, and that was a Saturday morning league. And I also played on a Sunday morning, or Sunday afternoon, sorry, for another team. But going back, let's just retrace just a little bit. You mentioned some famous exports from West Bromwich, and there's been quite a few. I think Julie Walters, the actress, is one of ours. One that most people don't know is a chap by the name of Phil Lynott, who was a singer back in the 70s and 80s with a band called Thin Lizzy. Now, he always portrayed himself as an Irishman, but he was actually born in West Bromwich and moved out to Ireland when he was probably about 6 years old. So, yeah, West Bromwich had a few famous exports.
Nice. I like that. I forgot about Julie Woods, actually.
She's one of ours. Claimer is one of ours. She's always one of ours until they do something wrong, and then oh no, she's from Smethwick, isn't it?
I love that because I do hear the little twang in her accent that I never noticed before. She's really lovely. She still has the slight black country and twanging even to this day. Okay, so you're also into athletics, which for some reason doesn't surprise me. So you switched football to athletics, so doing 400 metres and then 800 metres being your best events. Now that's interesting because I was rubbish over 100 metres for some reason.
Okay, 100 metres are sprints and 200 metres is a sprint, and they used to call, I think they probably still do call, 400 and 800 metres at middle distance running, but they are sprints. They are hard sprints and it hurts like hell. I'm glad I escaped from athletics.
So you went from athletics, very interestingly, into boxing. Now, I remember going into grandma's house and just seeing an entire, literally rows and rows and rows of your boxing trophies. So this is kind of my earliest memory, for me personally, of your kind of sporting achievements. So how did you go from athletics into boxing, which is quite a leap, quite different?
I am not an aggressive person in any way, shape or form, never have been. As you know, come from a very big family, they were always fighting amongst themselves, and I was the one who'd just be standing at the back and just letting it all carry on. And I could walk up to it afterwards and just talk to everybody. So I've never been into any form of aggression. But going back to when I was at school, probably about 14, 15 years old, there was a little altercation with a gang of first year kids, which I never thought anything of. And when I walked outside school at lunchtime, his big brother, who was about 18, was there waiting for me, and he gave me a real good hiding. I'd never ever had a fight in my life, never. I remember this guy was sitting on top of me and he was punching me, he was doing all sorts of horrible dirty things, spitting and rubbing dirt in my face. I had to go to hospital, and I had to go to the hospital and get stitched up and cleaned up. And it was one of those epiphanies, it was one of those great moments in my life. After I come out of the hospital, because I didn't hit him back, I was too scared. And I said to myself, that is the last time that somebody's going to do that to me. It's the first time and it's the last time. And I went out and I thought, I'm going to find somebody going to teach me how to fight. And I found Wednesbury Amateur Boxing Club and my own Mr. Miyagi. Len Wilkins was the coach there. He was fantastic. Yeah. He died a few years ago, Len. But he was fantastic. He coached me. I spent probably 6-7 years at Wednesbury as a boxer. And when I decided that I was going to retire from boxing, it was Len Wilkins that suggested that I stayed on at the club and took coaching qualifications and become a coach. And so, after a few years of boxing, I became a boxing coach and really loved it, loved every minute of it.
Wow, that's amazing, and that is interesting. really, really interesting. But the great thing about you, Uncle Lawrence, is that that's not even the tip of the iceberg of the most interesting things that you have done over the years. So you moved from how long did you stay as a boxing coach for? Or is that something that you did on and off through the years?
Right, okay. So I stayed at Wednesbury Amateur Boxing Club until, it must have been before I joined the fire, so it's mid-80s, early mid-80s, about 1985-ish, so it was a few years. But as I say, Len was my mentor, he was my coach, he talked me into staying on at boxing. And so I've coached a few lads over the years, and what's interesting now is that many of those young lads who I used to coach went on to have really good, successful boxing careers, and there are even some quite high-profile coaches now who have come through. Yeah, they've been taught by me, who I was taught by Len. Len's taught me, so we've left a legacy, and and hopefully these coaches now will go on and teach other coaches in the future.
Are you allowed to name drop?
No, don't do that to me, Donna. No. There's just some very awesome lads out there who've done very well in boxing, very well. And not just boxing. A little bit later on, we'll probably talk about some other stuff I've done with the young firefighters. And it's just this thing about leaving a legacy. We'll talk about the fire service stuff later on, but I was in the fire service, and I ran a youth group called the Young Firefighters probably for about 15 years. And the interesting thing is, a lot of those young people that I mentored back in those days, some are firefighters, some are policemen, some are soldiers, some pharmacists, a couple of teachers, but we can talk about that stuff later. But it's all about leaving a legacy. And that's what I love. That's why I love doing what I do.
In
helping people.
I absolutely respect that. And you're right. I'm going off piece. We haven't even gotten to the questions yet. But I really like that idea of leaving a legacy, because there's so many different ways that enabled you to do that. And it is through volunteering, it is through youth work, you can do it through coaching work and mentoring. And I forget that about that. I could go out and probably do some mentoring work, which is is important, and it's really amazing. So I'm glad we're actually talking about this. There's so many different ways to leave and create a legacy. It's incredible. Sorry, I'm digressing.
Yeah, and in fact, it's just triggered another thought, actually, because Len Wilkins wasn't even the very first. He was first, but there's another chap that came afterwards. A chap called Jim Swallow. Now, Jim Swallow was a guy that went to the church. He was one of the elders in the church that we went to when we were kids. Mm. And he used to run the church football team that I played for.
Right.
And when I got to, he knew that I was interested in cars and all that sort of stuff. And when I left school, I got a job in the garage as a trainee mechanic. But his day job, he was head of the automotive studies department at West Brom College. And he actually got me my apprenticeship. I didn't even have to go to an interview for my apprenticeship. He just called me to one side one day and said, look, I'll fix you up with an apprenticeship, just turn up at this garage on Monday morning and start. So he was the first one that leaned over and gave me a hand up. And I really love that. And I've always tried to help when I see kids out there struggling, I like to lean over and give them a hand up with the hope that one day they'll get to the point when they can lean over and give a kid a hand up. So I'm not quite sure whether Jim saw. Jim, I knew Jim before I knew Len, but Len did these bits first, and then Jim helped me out when I was about 17 with my apprenticeship. So I've forgotten about Jim. Yes.
No, but this is it, and this is really what this podcast is about. Is that you never forget those people that have really been there for you, inspired you, and pushed you into becoming the person that you are today. And this is exactly what this this is about. So we're moving on a little bit more into your life. So you've been went into the West Midlands Fire Service, which not the easiest job to be in. I can't even talk. The respect that I have, not just for you, but for any person that's in the fire service or any kind of these kind of services, because the one thing that there's been disasters, and most famously September 11th. Now, I've been to New York post September 11th, and I've been to Ground Zero, and probably one of the most moving parts for me, well, a lot of it was moving to be there at the Ground Zero, but was the fire station that was very, very close to the original Twin Towers, and it was shuttered, and there's this beautiful mural painted on the shutters of this now closed fire service, because that they lost all of their guys. They lost their entire watch, that building. And if there's anything, like I said, anyone that does this kind of job, I have the utmost respect to Paul, because you're running into situations where most people are actually running in the opposite direction, and the courage, the nerve, the guts, the resilience it takes for anyone to be able to do that is completely beyond me. So I absolutely take my hat off to you, Uncle, and every single person that's ever served and has been in fire service, because, you know, my utmost respect, like, seriously, most respect.
And thanks very much for that, but it almost happened by accident. I'm not naturally a sort of all action hero type person. What happened was, back in the 1980s, when I was a motor mechanic, I'd done my apprenticeship, and I was doing jobs on the side at weekends, lying underneath cars and taking gearboxes out on my chest and getting mouthfuls of gearbox oil and really loving it. Not okay. What I was really interested in, though, back then, was vehicle electrics. And back in the mid 1980s, my thoughts were that cars of the future were all going to be electronic. And so I actually went back to college. I went back to college and studied. I'd done a course in electronic equipment servicing. And whilst I was on that course, I met a fireman. I was doing the full-time course, he was doing a part-time course in electronics. And it was him that mentioned to me, he said, why don't you become a firefighter? Or a fireman, as he called them back in those days. And I thought, oh, gosh, no, that's not for me. There's too much smoke. I don't like smoke. In those days, people used to smoke in pubs and bars. And even when I was boxing, we used to box in a lot of like working men's clubs, like single story buildings with low ceilings. And the ring was like 4 foot off the floor. And they all used to smoke. And so I was always boxing in a smoke cloud. If you think about it, absolutely horrible when you think about it. And of course, back in those, okay, when you're boxing, the better you get, the later on in the program that you're on. So I was frequently top of the bill, you know, last fight of the night. They've been smoking in there from 7 o'clock in the evening. It's like now 11:30, and there was a smoke cloud. Yeah, your head was in the smoke cloud. So I really didn't like smoke at all. So the idea of becoming a firefighter, oh gosh, no, not for me. But my thinking was, well, maybe whilst I'm just learning my electronics, I could do this firefighting job just to earn a bit of cash, and just for a couple of years. So I joined up, and I think I just forgot to leave.
You forgot to leave.
So that's just having too much fun. Yeah, that's how it all started. Yeah.
And you was in the fire service for quite a long, was it 27 years?
27 years, yeah, 27 years eventually. Mm. Joined the fire service back in 87, it was, I think, 1987. You do, the way that it works is you do 3 months at a residential training school where they teach you all the basics, how to use all of the equipment that's on a fire engine. Mm-hmm. And then after your 3 months of basic training, you get posted out to a fire station. Went out to Highgate in Birmingham, big inner city fire station, doing about 5,000 fire calls a year. Wow. It was super, super busy. Now, in the normal run things, you were a trainee firefighter or a probationer firefighter for 4 years. It took 4 years to get fully qualified. After 4 years, you could then get on sort of full firefighter's pay. And I never actually made it. I never made it to full firefighter's pay.
Really?
I had a fantastic boss, Bill the Drill, used to call him, real stickler. If you could think of Sir Alex Ferguson, broad Glaswegian, real hard as nails. Tell you what, they must have been in the same class, exactly the same sort of character. Mm-hmm. Now, not many people liked Bill, but Bill and me got on like a house on fire. He said to me when I first started there, he said, look, you're a probationary firefighter. You've got all of the exams every week. We were a very, very busy station. So he said, you'll do your exam paper on the last night shift of every tour of duty. We used to do 2 days, two nights, and then 4 days off. He said, we are a very busy fire station, and it may well be 5 o'clock in the morning by the time you get round to do your exam paper every week, but you will do it. And so I did. I just did it. Just got on with it. And we got on very well. And because I'd got Bill as my mentor in the fire service, I went through all my probationary stuff quite early. I passed all the promotion exams. Before I was a qualified firefighter, I became a leading firefighter. I got promoted before I actually made it to qualified firefighter status. So there was the first rank, everybody starts as a fireman, and then there's leading fireman, and then sub-officer, and then station officer, with exams for every rank. I passed my leading fireman's exam. There's two parts to it, one in the winter and one in the summer. I passed both parts of my leading fireman's exam in my first year on station.
Yeah.
In my second year on station, I passed both parts of my sub-officer's exam. Actually failed my station officer's exam the first time, but in my fourth year, I think I'd just been promoted to leading fireman, I passed my station officer's exam. So I whistled through the exams pretty quickly and got promoted before I actually made it to qualified fireman. That was interesting. But Bill was probably very much like my dad, real stickler. I mean, the story, my parents came to England back in the late 1950s, after the end of the Second World War, by invitation of the UK government to help rebuild the country after the war.
Yeah.
And Dad's first job when he came to England was in national service in the Royal Air Force.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So he served in the RAF. Now, I'm not quite sure that is where he learned to be an authoritarian dictator, or that was just part of his makeup. But he certainly didn't spare the rod or spoil the child, as it were. So we had a very strict, disciplined upbringing. And I think I just found Bill the Drill, because he was that sort of person. He was what I needed for the next part of my development.
That's very interesting when you have, when you grow up with very formidable parents, that you find yourself getting on with difficult people or people that other people run away from. Because I have a little bit of that. I, for some reason, get on with, especially, but I have a bit of a knack to kind of get on with very difficult females. I don't know why. There's a few characters and a few women that a lot of people don't get on with or can't get on with, but for some reason I get on with them, because I think I just understand where they're coming from, probably a little bit more. So okay. I find it very interesting that you say, hey, you got on with Bill Drill, probably because you had this very much this is it authoritarian?
Authoritarian.
Authoritarian. That's the word you're trying to get out. Upbringing, which, yeah. For a lot of people, it can be quite tough.
Yeah, I've got a big up dad here because, you know, it has been really difficult for him coming into a very strange country and being a little bit different to most of the other people here. And it was the usual story, you know, they came here with very little in the way of money. But the one thing that he did was he managed to buy, not one, it was two sets of Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, people of a certain age will know what Encyclopedia Britannica is and was, but they were a very, very expensive set of encyclopedias, and he bought two sets. Must have run to several months' wages just for those. But the idea behind those was that he was going to make sure that all of his children learned to read, and we'd have to figure out the rest from there. So although he had not much to give us in the way of material things, what he did give us was of immense value. I learned to read not with Peter and Jane books, but with Encyclopedia Britannica. I had to start at the top and go back. As in, you know, brothers and sisters, that's how we all learned to read. So things must have been very tough back in those days.
I mean, I love that because it's something that does just pop up a lot. And when I talk about these, we talk about our parents, because obviously my mom's your old sister. And I also, it took me many, many years to understand, just like, and even my other friends that have, and guests that have done these interviews said, you know, they did what they knew at the time. And they did the best of what they knew at the time what I had to do. And it's just like our generation, my generation now. And it's so true. We've got a whole different wealth of information out there. We have the internet. You know, if I was a parent today and I didn't know how to cope with my child, I could just put in a Google search. Why is my kid crying? How do I not murder my kid? You know, and we'll probably get a load of self-help books like coming back at me from written by loads of different people from all different parts of the world that kind of help through. And you know, but that's what's available to us now. It wasn't available back then. And you know, our parents and grandparents and great grandparents were literally only doing what they knew. And there's also the phrase that it takes a village to raise a child. And as you're saying, with you know, grandma and granddad coming over here, where was that village? They come over here by themselves. And one of the things about the Windrush generation is that yes, there was a bit of community and that kind of camaraderie, I guess, but coming over to rebuild, I talk about Windrush a lot as well, to under invitation to the mother country, not that anyone can see my air quotes, to rebuild and restructure, and to come over here but be treated with disdain because you didn't know what, unbeknownst to the Caribbean people coming over, is that there was a load of propaganda on the other side, that which is similar to what happens now with Brexit, let's face it, of the coming over, taking our jobs, they're not welcome. So you had all these people coming over on these hopes and promises of being built, being included in the rebuild, and was met with animosity, disdain, racism, you know.
And I won't try and excuse any of that, but it was something new for the British people as well. It was new experiences for them, and they got to grow into it. And the remnants of it are still here, still blatant. But you know, we are making slow progress. We're getting there.
I hope so. I always end up going down this road. I don't know how I end up going down this road.
Well, but let's keep it bright. Let's move on to something a bit brighter.
So, I'm going to ask this because we've been chatting for quite a while now and I haven't even gotten over to my questions. But I'm going to talk to you. So, we're still in the midst of this pandemic. You know, vaccinations being rolled out. So, and I always say this, I'm not going to say anyone yes, should or should not. It's always up to each and every individual to make their decision based on what they're comfortable with. So, what have you been doing the past year now during this pandemic to kind of keep yourself sane mentally? Sane and healthy, and how you gotten through all of this?
Oh right, okay. Well, over the years, I've grown to be mentally tough because I've had to. I've been doing a bit of exercise, a bit of walking, that sort of stuff. But in the first lockdown, when we couldn't go anywhere, I thought, right, okay, this is an opportunity. This is an opportunity to do something I haven't done yet. And again, I've got many, many interests, but one thing I've always wanted to learn was digital marketing. So I spent a lot of time learning about selling and marketing. I've done a couple of courses. I've got a couple of things out there on the internet for sale and all that sort of stuff. And I'm still working on that. My next career, my very next career, is going to be as a digital marketer.
I like that.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't see selling and marketing as trying to get people to buy things that they don't want to buy. I'm coming from the view of helping people to get what it is that they're looking for, to source the products that they're looking for. I do have a little bit of a tagline. Learn new skills is my blog that I'm working on, with hyphens if you're looking it up. Learn new skills, and the tagline for that is helping the teachers to teach the learners how to teaching the teachers to teach the learners how to learn.
I like that.
Teachers how to teach the learners how to learn. So that's where I'm coming from with my digital marketing stuff. It is helping people to help other people and themselves, of course.
Okay, so we're going to go back to that, and you know, how do my listeners kind of find you and get involved if they wish to be involved in learning these new skills?
There's some stuff on my blog. The blog isn't mega yet, but the blog is learnnewskills.com, learn-new-skills.com.
Okay.
Some stuff on my blog there. That's a work in progress, and once that's fleshed out, you'll be able to find me on there anyway.
Looking forward to it. Can't wait.
So that's that little bit. Walking. Got to keep the, because that's something that I was going to come on to a little bit later. That as you get older, it becomes more in your face that you've got to now start looking after your physical body and your mental health.
Yeah.
As you get older, as you know, things start wearing out and not working as well as they used to. And that's the way old age gets you. It goes for your joints first to slow you down. and then turns you into a couch potato.
Yeah.
Just something to be aware of.
I'm aware of it. I'm aware of it already, especially now that I've moved into remote working and staying at home. I'm thinking I need to move. I need to move more than what I'm doing, and it is quite bad. But yeah, I'm very aware of it. I just need a routine to get me out of it, to be honest.
Yeah, it's great when you're young, you know, in your 20s and your 30s, you're running about everywhere, you're running, you're dancing. I mean, that's one thing I miss. I miss my dancing. I haven't done any dancing at all in the past year. Now, I'm not sure whether you know, actually.
Do you do salsa?
I've been doing salsa. Yes, I do. Cuban salsa. I've been doing Cuban salsa for about 5 years now.
Oh, wow.
When I say 5 years, it's probably been about 6 years, but absolutely not in the last year. We've got nobody to dance with. Can't get any close enough to anyone to dance with them.
That's kind of sad, really, isn't it? It's not exactly the sort of thing that you can just do over a Zoom call or a Zoom clap. It's just
they've tried. I know the school had run a few classes on Zoom and that sort of stuff, but it's not the same. And you can't do any partner work if you don't have a partner. Okay, but that's something to look forward to when things open up again, is going back to dance classes and going out to parties on a Saturday night and swinging girls around the dance floor and all that sort of stuff.
That's something definitely to look forward to. I'm just looking forward to, personally, catching up with family, being able to have a meal at a decent restaurant. I think that's really the most that I'm looking forward to. I'm not really running to get to a club or a wine bar, to be honest, but just being able to just go out for a meal with friends and families is what I look most forward to more than anything. Dancing.
Yeah.
I've never taken a dance class in my life, not since I was a kid, so, but I love that idea.
I did actually, because again, something I'd forgotten about, was back in the late 1970s, I did start taking dance classes, and it was the time of Saturday Night Fever and Grease and all that sort of stuff. There was a dance club in West Brom that I used to go to, and that lasted a year or two, but the chap that I used to go with unfortunately died. He got killed in a motorbike accident, and I never went again. Yeah. Oh, okay, it's one of those things, but but I'd love to have kept up my dancing, and I didn't for years and years, and a few years ago, just back into it. As soon as I was back into a dance club, I remembered how much fun I used to have.
You just reminded me as well, because I haven't touched on this. You mentioned your friend also passed on a motorcycle, but you like your bikes as well.
A motorbike. Yes, I have had my bike in the garage waiting for summer to turn up. I am a fair weather biker. I'm proud of it. unless we are well into double figures and that big yellow thing comes up in the sky, that bike stays in the garage.
I don't blame you.
I always wanted a motorbike from when I was young. I don't know whether you'd remember Ian, Carol's ex-boyfriend, Jason's dad. Yes. He got me to bikes. So when I was about 12, years old, he had a motorbike. He was older than me, so he would have been about 17 at the time, 17, 18. I was about 12. And he used to take me everywhere on his bike, and I got bitten by the bug then. I think I wanted the bike when I was 17, but passed my driving test in the middle of winter and it was cold and it was snowing, so I bought a car instead. And I think I had my first motorbike when I was about 32.
Really?
I had the bike when I was about 32, had that for a few years and sold it. And then it was a few years later, I think it was your Uncle Jeff said to me, "Do you fancy getting another motorbike and coming on a tour of France?" I thought, that sounds like a great idea. Ricky was there as well at the same time, and Ricky said, "Yeah, I want to come too." I says, "That's That's going to pose a bit of a challenge, Ricky, because at the time, Ricky hadn't got a motorbike, and he hadn't got a motorbike license. But he said, leave it with me, I'll fix that. And within a few weeks, Ricky had passed his motorbike test, and he went out and bought a 1000cc sports bike. I was like, oh no. Recipe for disaster. And like, I can remember Mum saying at the time, because yeah, we were going to France, big trip abroad. And Mum was saying, you know, don't go. I said, Mum, you know, we're big boys now, you know. I was probably in my, well into my 40s, you know. And just as we were leaving, she came to me, looked me in the eye, and said, you're the oldest. Bring my babies back safe.
No pressure.
No pressure. Okay, so what I did is I got hold of the maps and kept them in my pocket, so everybody had to wait behind me. just a little story if we can on this French trip. Ricky, as I say, very inexperienced motorcyclist, just passed his motorbike test, and we were in France, and okay, the plan was if we got split up, if we got lost, then what we do, we just wait at the next petrol station. We all catch up there. But I think Jeff was in front. Jeff was leading the way, and I was behind Jeff, and Ricky was behind me. And you know, Ian and the chap was with us. And Ricky came flying past us. Yeah, you know, it's a nice bit of road. Ricky came flying past us. Now, of course, I was looking well ahead, as was Jeff, and you know, when the road disappears in front of you, you know there's a sharp bend coming up. And Ricky came flying past us, thought, what is he doing? And then, I suppose Ricky must have seen this bend at the last moment, and I thought, oh no, what am I going to find when I get round this bend? And we got round the bend, and Ricky had made it.
Wow.
I don't know how. He doesn't know how, but it was close. But we digress. But there's some great maybe if you invite me back for another podcast, remind me to tell the story about what happened in France, because that is one of the most influential things in my life. It's been amazing. Yeah. Something amazing happened in France. But we haven't got time to talk about it on this podcast.
Yeah, we'll come back to it.
Maybe if you invite me back, just write that question. Now ask me what happened in France.
I'm writing it right down right now. What happened in France? I love it. Okay.
Okay.
So, are you ready for what actually is officially my first question?
Yes, okay. Yeah, come on, let's go for it then.
I love this interview. So, So, what is the best piece of advice that someone from the older generation has ever given you that shaped the person that you are today?
Right, okay. Now, that is a very good question, and the piece of advice, the very best piece of advice came from a source that was so unlikely. It goes back to my school days. We used to have a housemaster who liked everybody to call him Uncle Jack. Uncle Jack was our housemaster. He was a big strapping lad, probably about in his 50s. And again, another one of these authoritarian figures that I seem to draw myself to. Uncle Jack was our housemaster, and I don't think he liked me very much. Not because I was such a bad lad, but I think what it was that because I was so restricted at home, when I got out and went to school, I was a little bit wild, just a little bit. I wasn't bad, but just a little bit wild. And back in those days, of course, it was days where if you'd done something wrong, you'd up to see the housemaster, and you'd bend over outside his office, and he'd thrash you with his cane with gusto. Nice. I think I was Uncle Jack's second best customer for the cane. his best customer was a real good friend of mine, a chap called Dickie. He's called Dickie. Dickie was an African lad. He came from Nigeria. His parents had sent him to England to get educated. I think he was staying with one of his father's friends. But Dickie was as wild as a buck goat. He was bonkers. He was dark side. And I think he was Uncle Jack's best customer. I was Uncle Jack's second best customer, the sixth of the best. School report time. Our school reports came in a little booklet. So A4 is a single size, so A5 would be half a page. This booklet would be about A6, about an A6 booklet. And each subject teacher used to write little comments for about how you'd fared over the year. And then the very last page was a summing up by the housemaster. This was my very last school report. I was walking out of the school gates forever, never coming back. Didn't really care what they wrote. some of the comments quite promising, because I enjoyed some subjects. I love PE, of course. I've done quite well in English. I surprised a lot of people by doing well in maths, but that's another story. But woodwork, didn't really like woodwork, couldn't get on with woodwork. And we had this teacher, I'm not going to say his name in case he's still alive, but he used to have a very well-groomed beard and moustache, like a Prince Harry sort of beard and moustache, but very well-groomed. And we reckoned if you turned him upside down, he'd look like a toilet brush. So we were very cruel. I mean, his name was Bogbrush. And Bogbrush wrote in my school report that Lawrence had wasted an opportunity to learn a very worthwhile pastime. Because I just used to go to woodwork and play up. And then at the end, Uncle Jack wrote his comments. And he wrote something to the effect of, Lawrence didn't like woodwork, so he gave up. What he must learn is that it is very wrong to give up on anything. And I read that. Here was me, cocky little kid, walking out of school gates, not ever coming back again, don't care what you write. I read that and it shook me to my boots. Oh gosh, that is exactly what I'd done. I'd given up. And in fact, it even reminded me that this was a character trait that I displayed before. I can remember running in an 800 meter race. Now, I can't remember whether I was running for Sandwell, running for the County. It was an 800 meter race. As I said before, 800 meters is a really tough race. It's a sprint, 2 laps of the track. And it was hard going. It was a blistering pace. And I was struggling. I was up with the pack, with the leading pack, and we'd done 1 3/4 laps. We were coming around the last bend. We got 150 meters to go, and I was done. I'd got nothing left. I thought, I'm not going to be able to keep up this pace for the next 150 meters. And I sort of pretended to be tripped and fell over. I couldn't take the pace. I gave up. And I thought, that is you. When things get tough, you give up. And I'm glad I learned it at such an early age. Since then, I've been as tenacious as a dog with a bone, with gravy on it, about anything that I do. But it wasn't until that moment that I realized that, that is what I do. When things get tough, when things get hard, I find a way, I duck out. And that to me, that one little piece of advice from a bloke who I thought didn't really like me very much has shaped who I am, but not just shaped who I am, because I'm sure I've rubbed this off on a lot of other young people I've been working with. It's been the cornerstone of a lot of the stuff that I've been teaching them, is to, you know, work, you know, you have a plan, you work through something. If you don't succeed, then you pick yourself up, you dust yourself off, you look at what you did right, you look at what you would do differently, and you have another go. And if that doesn't work, you get up, you dust yourself off, you look at what you did right, you look at what you could do differently, you adjust it, and you have another go. And as I say to the kids, and when do you stop trying?
Yep.
And the answer, of course, is you don't stop trying. You keep on going until you do it. When you were a baby, yeah, you're lying in that pram and you're looking up at all these big people walking. You think, yeah, that stuff looks really useful. I want to do that walking. So you have a go. You know, you grab hold of the settee and you pull yourself up onto your legs and you go one step and then two steps and you boom. So you get up and grab on the settee and you pull yourself up and you take another one step and two steps and down you go again.
Yeah.
At no stage do you ever think, oh, I don't want to do this silly walking anyway. No. You just keep on going, you keep on trying, and you get all sorts of enthusiasm and, from those around you, from your parents. Like, come on, girl, you can do it, and they cheer you on. And they say, he just spoke, he said, Mama, he said, Dada. And they go, yeah, well. And then you keep on doing it, you keep on practicing, and you're learning, you get ready to take one step, this time you do three steps, and you go down again, and they give you more encouragement.
Yeah.
And you get up, you take four steps, and they give you more encouragement, and then you make it all the way across the room, and they go, yeah! And then once you've mastered it, then sit down and shut up.
It's so, the back in place.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, okay. So, we're not born that way. We're not born learning how to give up. We have to learn how to give up. Yes, a lot of it was reinforced by the sit down and shut up method, message. We came out of the womb as these fantastic beings that could do anything and would have a go at anything, would try anything.
Yep.
And we have to learn how to give up. And so what I've been trying to do with all these young people I've been working with over the years is to unlearn a lot of this negative stuff that's been programmed into them.
Yes.
Not just by their parents, but from society.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even watch the news anymore because it's just so full of negative stuff.
Mm.
But there's just so much negativity around. And when people struggle, when people find things difficult, the tendency is now to give up. And it's okay to give up because the government will look after you. Can't get a job. Okay, it's no problem. And there are people out there who are out of work, can't find work, can't get work for whatever. Some people aren't physically able. You know, they're disabled people that can't do things. But there's this great big nanny state that will then say, it's okay. You don't need to. You can sit on your wall and drink beer all day. We'll fund that. And so they just give up. When really we could do with a nation full of heroes that get up and charge at the next thing, and okay, intelligently, but when things knock you down, you get up, you find a way around it, under it, over it, or just blow the damn thing up and go through it.
That is that is very interesting. That you say that about people. There's very different ways why and how that makes people give up, and you're right, there are some societal views and societal pressures that have such a negative impact on so many people, and you're completely right. And some people, it's just a situation that they're in at that given moment, and they need help and support and encouragement to kind of get out of it. And then there's always going to be the other side of society where there are people that are in their what they think is a sweet spot, think they don't have that motivation to kind of move forward and move out of it. And it is almost because of this, because of the nanny state, they sit there thinking, well, what is there more for me? What is there more to do? You know, this isn't perfect, but I don't know anything else. And it's because sometimes I haven't been shown or encouraged anything else. So yeah, I get what you're saying completely 100%.
Yeah, but that is the exact reason why we should all reach out to young people, especially before they even form these sort of habits of giving up and being lazy and being idle. Because yeah, when you look out on the world now, it's very difficult for young people get to school leaving age. There's not a great deal you can do if you don't go off to university. Apprenticeships, there are one or two, but not enough to educate the, you know, keep the young people learning and occupied and progressing and moving upwards. And a lot of the work I've been doing with young people is geared around firing them up, getting them to get up and do something and make something of themselves, and also help other people. Yeah, because I haven't made it to this age on my own. I've had some great teachers on the way, and Uncle Jack being one of them. If it wasn't for that one comment in my school report, I don't know when I would have noticed that trait in myself.
Yeah,
I would have noticed it eventually, and other people would have noticed it. But I'm glad I noticed it at the age of 16. So that's quite a young enough age to nip it in the bud and do something about it. And I'm so pleased that I had the gumption to recognise that was the case and want to do something about it. But if kids don't see this in themselves, then they won't even know that they've got to do something about it.
And it's not just knowing it and seeing it. It's sometimes it's the right person saying it to them in the right way that kind of makes it suddenly click. Because you could be told something continuously by the wrong source, like say for instance your parents, or you know, a teacher that you didn't like. You're this, you're that, you're lazy, you're silly, you're not going to make anything of your life, you're not going to get anywhere. And that kind of negative reinforcement in the child is always going to have a knock-on effect. But you just might just take that one person to just say it in a different way. It's like, you know, you're not a stupid person. It's just that you give up, or you get bored easily, or you're easily distracted. No, that's one thing I got a lot in my report, is that, you know, I talked too much and I was easily and I was easily distracted. And I still am easily distracted. I'm starting to think maybe I have ADHD and I never knew. I get even to this day, it's just like at this age, I get distracted and it's just like, oh, something shiny on the floor.
Shiny objects. In fact, I'm glad you mentioned that, Donna, because I can resonate with that. Unfortunately, Dad, as you said earlier, he did the very best he could with the tools that he had at the time. But I can remember taking several beatings. And at the same time as the beatings were coming down, being told that I was no good and good for nothing, which at a young age is a horrible sort of thing to drive into the psyche of a young person. But that stuck with me for a while. But I remember when I was about 13, 14, it was in my football days, and I used to play for the church football team. There's a chap called Les Hartle. He used to run the football team with Jim Swallow. And we played one game against the top team, the 12th West Bromwich Boys Brigade. They were the best team in the league. And I think we beat them. We beat them that day. I was always a defender. I was just playing defence. And he said to me, "You played like Pelé." Now, you mentioned earlier about all the trophies that used to be in mom's house when I was growing up. I don't know how many trophies I had, over 100. But there was one trophy, and right in front of me, hang on, on my windowsill, I don't know if you can see this.
No, you ain't got your camera on,
I haven't got my camera on. You joking? Oh, sorry, Donna. I can see you. I thought you could see me. I was thinking, whoa.
Hello, you what are you shy?
Yeah, all this time I've been looking at you. I thought you could see. Now, can you see this?
Yeah, I can. Oh, wow.
This is... okay, now I know that other people won't be able to see what I'm showing you, but they're listening. Mm-hmm. This is a little football trophy. This is the first trophy I ever got, and it was from the Good Shepherd football team, and I got Player of the Season, because Les Hartle told me I played like Pele, and that was the first time in my life that somebody ever told me I was good at anything. And that, again, has left something deep in my psyche. So whenever I work with a young person now, I'm looking for that one thing that they're good at, and focus on that, hone in on that, bring that out.
Brilliant.
And you can literally watch them blossom. That's when you tell a young kid they're good at something. Again, a lot of the young people I've been working with, some of them were young offenders, some of these people, kids, when I was doing the young firefighters, there's a family who used to be foster carers, and whenever they had a new foster kid in, they would bring him along to the young firefighters, because they loved what I could do with their kids. Yeah. And it was great, because you can, every child that's in care has got baggage. They are there because something's gone horribly wrong in their life. Not even going to go into some of the stuff, but they've all got challenges. But if you are that one person that finds that one little spark within them that says, hey, you know, kid, you're good at that. That was great. And you spend your time trying to catch them doing something right, you can literally just watch them blossom.
That's amazing.
You watch them change in. And I can always remember with the young firefighters, there's one little kid in particular, it had really, really horrible abuse as a child. And this abuse that he had as a child came out as sort of horrible behavior. Mm-hmm. That was unacceptable to everybody else. Now, I remember having a chat with the other instructors at the young firefighters. They wanted me to get rid of him because he was just so disruptive. Mm-hmm. But I thought, no, I'm going to stick with him. I'm going to work with him for as long as I possibly can. And I'm rather hoping that, I mean, you know, that kid's probably in his 30s now. Mm-hmm. But I'm rather hoping, I haven't seen him, but I'm rather hoping that something that I did with him has turned him around and he's made a success of his life. But I spend a lot of time just trying to find just even the tiniest little thing that he would do right and jump on it. Yes, I saw that. Yep. And you big it up and you build them up, and you know, you catch them doing something right and they want to do something else right. We all crave that sort of stuff, don't we? Yeah. And children especially. And you can drive a message really, really deep by beating them, telling them no good, good for nothing, or catching them doing something right and driving that message deep into their psyche.
Love it.
Both will have a massive effect.
And you can be that is completely 100%. It's just you've got the negative reinforcement and then the positive reinforcement, and both can literally counteract and balance out each other. Because you might have completely the opposite, where a kid's been given positive reinforcement in all their life to the point where they don't know what criticism is, and they don't realise what it's like in the real world until they go out and think, hang on, I can't cope with rejection, I can't cope with failure, because, you know, you've been told you're the best. And, you know, it's always a balance between the two, really and truly.
Yeah.
It's
I've heard stories about
positive reinforcement actually becoming negative. They just say it's push your parents.
Well, yeah. I've heard stories about Warren Buffett, one of the richest men on the planet, and I think his plan is to leave his children with a very, very minimal sort of inheritance, because he doesn't want to rob them of the opportunity to make a go at life for themselves.
I've heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah, harsh, but my character building.
Or is it harsh?
Yeah.
Or is it? Oh, okay.
Definitely character building.
Yeah, so. That's. Yeah. Dad is the richest man in the world. I can't pay my rent this month. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm sure they've done fine.
If they listened to half of what Dad said, they've got a load of investments there.
Gosh, yeah.
I'm ready for.
Okay, so that was part one of my interview with Lawrence. I hope you enjoy. Please stay tuned for part two, which I'll be dropping in a couple of weeks, no longer than that. As always, I love to hear from you and get your feedback, so please find me on the socials. As you know, I'm on Twitter, Facebook and YouTube. I am working on a website and it is up, it is live, it's not perfect, however it has got all my links to leave me a message, a voice message, and also how to support this podcast, as well as the links to all the major podcast softwares, from Apple to Verbal. I am on Verbal, which is quite a new one, so please go on, like and subscribe to each and every single one of these. I appreciate every single one of you. So if you want to find all my links in one place, it is tmystmos1.com. So that is tmystmos1.com. So it's to my young self, to my old self.com. Just the letters and the number one. Check it out. All my links are on there. And don't forget to like and subscribe on wherever you get your podcasts. It's appreciated. Thank you very much. Have a good day. Stay safe and take care of yourself and each other. Thank you.